Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. Welcome to the National Press Club. My name is Allen Adams. I'm chairman of the Board of Governors of the National Press Club and an editor with Research Recommendations. I'd like to welcome club members and their guests in the audience today, as well as those of you watching on C-SPAN or listening to the program on National Public Radio or the Global Internet Computer Network. This is our last luncheon for 1995, and we have already begun to line up an impressive list of speakers for 1996. Members should look to their future editions of the record for more details. And if you are hooked up to the Internet, the National Press Club's homepage has the most up-to-date list of upcoming speakers, as well as other information about the club. Transcripts and audio and video tapes of the Press Club luncheons are available by calling 1-800-NPC-2334. The National Press Club is also pleased to announce the publication of a new book, The National Press Club's Best Contemporary Speakers, a book containing 13 of the best speeches made during 1994. To order a copy, call 1-800-211-4020. If you have any questions for our speakers, please write them on the cards at your table and pass them up to me. I will ask as many as time permits. I'd now like to introduce our head table guests and ask them to stand briefly while their names are called. From your right, Michael Doan, Kiplinger Washington Letter, Bill Hershey, Akron Beacon Journal, Bob Cooney, Executive Editor, Press Associates, Patrick Mirza, Editor, You and the Law, Michelle Amber, Daily Labor Report, Linda Chavez Thompson, Executive Vice President, AFL-CIO. And passing over our speaker, Reggie Stewart, Assistant News Editor, Knight Ridder Newspapers, and member of the National Press Club Speakers Committee who arranged today's luncheon, Richard Trumka, Secretary-Treasurer, AFL-CIO. Adrienne Flynn, Arizona Republic. Bill Eaton, Curator of the Hubert H. Humphrey Fellowship Program at the University of Maryland School of Journalism and a former labor reporter. Heather Hope, Congressional Quarterly. Vic Ostrowitzky, Hearst Newspapers. And I'd like to thank staff members Melissa Bender, Pat Nelson, Melanie Abdow-Dermott, and Howard Rothman for organizing today's luncheon. The U.S. labor movement has a new leader with a challenge that many believe defies the odds. The challenge? To organize millions of new workers into unions that have failed to stay with the growth of the workforce to the point where they represent just 1 in 6 American workers overall and less than that in the private sector. The litany of troubles facing the AFL-CIO Federation and its 78 unions is familiar to all. The decline in the industrial union stronghold, the rise in the non-union service sector, international competition, low-wage foreign workers. But look at the other side of the coin, the side that could spell opportunity. Stagnant wages for the middle class, downsizing, job insecurity, a mushrooming temporary workforce. Can John Sweeney and organized labor bridge the gap? Will workers once again flock to unions as they did in the 30s and 40s? In those days, unions had much needed assistance from a political system that today hardly appears ready to dispense favors. Takeaway is more likely. The man on who this challenge falls, and he asked for it, is a 61-year-old New Yorker who grew up in a working-class family and studied economics while attending Iona College not far from his home in the Bronx. After graduation, Mr. Sweeney went to work at IBM for $90 a week, but quit for a job offer at the Ladies Garment Workers Union for $60 a week. We must assume this is not the economic direction Mr. Sweeney intends to lead the American worker as he takes on his new duties. Mr. Sweeney is here today to tell us the direction he is headed and how he means to get there. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming AFL-CIO President John J. Sweeney.
Thank you very much, Allen Adams, for such a graceful introduction. Reggie Stewart for arranging all of the business of getting us here. I'm really delighted to be invited to speak to you on behalf of American workers and their families. I want to, at the outset, thank the working press for the way that they have helped us over the past year in raising the perception of the labor movement on so many different occasions. I'm happy to be here and pleased that there are a number of members of the Executive Council of the AFL-CIO and presidents of their own unions, together with Rich Trumka and Linda Chavez Thompson, my team at the AFL-CIO. We have with us Arthur Coyer, the President of the Laborers, Joe Green, President of the School Administrators, Frank Hanley, President of the Operating Engineers, George Corpus, who just had a great settlement at Boeing strike, President of the Machinists, and Jim Norton from the Graphic Arts, and I'm sure I've overlooked somebody. I'm also happy to see Vince Sombrato from the Letter Carriers, as well as my successor at SEIU, our new president, Dick Kortz. And representing the Sweeney family, my wife has the flu, is my daughter, Trish. So I'm delighted to have all of my supporters here here today and happy to have this opportunity. 2 weeks ago, I had the honor of joining President Clinton on the journey of peacemaking all across Ireland. Most Americans think of the problem in Northern Ireland as a religious and political divide, and of course it is. But it's important to understand that this generation of the Troubles began because of an economic divide as well. In 1968, large numbers of Catholics began to protest against the discrimination that denied them good jobs in growing industries. They were inspired in part by the civil rights struggle in our own country, which was a movement for jobs and freedom. After more than a quarter century of struggle, progress is being made. That is why one of our first stops in Northern Ireland was at the Mackey Engineering Works plant in Belfast. For years, that plant has been a symbol of discrimination and division. Now it is a symbol of progress and peace. On the shop floor, Catholics and Protestants work together. At the bargaining table, labor and management are cooperating. Productivity, profits, and wages are all rising, and management is investing in new equipment and new jobs. The lesson is clear. Where there is dignity for everyone, everyone wins. What is happening at Mackey may happen throughout Northern Ireland, thanks in large measure to President Clinton's brave peacemaking. Catholics and Protestants, Dublin and London, are closer together than at any time in a generation. In that land of pain and poetry, hope and healing may finally prevail over division and despair. That is why I found more joyous optimism on the streets of Derry and Belfast than I've seen in Detroit or the Bronx. In fact, I felt mixed feelings about coming back from the peacemaking in Ireland to the problems here at home. Conflict at Caterpillar, newspaper strike in Detroit, contract talks in New York City, and the difficulties here in Washington, from the district building to Capitol Hill, they almost made me miss the relative tranquility of Belfast. Of course, that journey made me prouder than ever of everything America is doing to make peace in Northern Ireland, the Middle East, and the Balkans. I am here today to talk about what we can do to reach another historic agreement, a new social compact between business and labor, to find new ways to grow the American economy, American companies, and American wages in the new world economy, and to bridge the growing gap between the great majority of Americans who are working longer and harder for less and the fortunate few who are prospering as never before. Andy Warhol used to say that everyone will be famous for 15 minutes here at the National Press Club. You give us 20 minutes. I promise you that before my 20 minutes are up, I'll give you a preview of what labor will do next year and a prediction about the 1996 elections. To the journalists here today, let me offer this advice. The biggest story of our time will be whether America can find a way to restore the sense that we are all moving and advancing together, not sinking separately. I am a product of the social compact that lifted America out of the Great Depression and lifted working Americans into the middle class. My father was an Irish immigrant, a New York City bus driver, and a proud member of the Transport Workers Union. Some of my earliest memories are of going to union meetings with him. We'd listen to Mike Quill, whose brogue was better than some I heard in Dublin and Derry. And he would explain paycheck economics to workers and their families. Those were tough times, but working people, business people, and public officials shared certain understandings, a social contract, if you will. Here's what working people knew. If we got up every morning and did our jobs, then we could earn a better life for ourselves and a better chance for our children. Here's what business people knew. If they paid their workers fairly and plowed some of their profits back into their communities, they could count on loyal employees and loyal consumers. For companies back then, good citizenship was good business. And here's what our leaders in government understood, and President Kennedy said it best, a rising tide lifts all boats. For almost 30 years after winning World War II, we all prospered because we prospered together. We were concerned with raising the standard of living for all Americans, not just accumulating enormous wealth for a fortunate few. That social compact was a formula for the strongest economy, the largest middle class, and the most successful society this world has ever known. Unfortunately, those days are gone. You all have reported what happened, the oil embargo of 1973, global economic competition, new technologies, and the deregulation of the domestic economy from transportation to communications. Business found new ways to compete, ways that may succeed in the short term, but which I submit to you are short-sighted and ultimately self-destructive. They competed not by American teamwork and American know-how, but by driving down labor costs. Caught in an unforgiving global economy, corporate America too often squeezed the last possible ounce of productivity out of American workers, and then threw them on the scrap heap of unemployment or old age with reduced pensions and health coverage. Consider the stories you've reported on the business page. Chase Manhattan and Chemical Bank announce a merger that will put 12,000 people out of work, and their stock goes up. Does a rising tide now sink all ships, except for the luxury yachts? And what's wrong with this picture? Caterpillar is doing great, racking up record profits, enjoying great productivity. So they decide to install a two-tier wage system, schedule work on the weekends without paying overtime, and reject pattern bargaining. They force thousands of workers out on strike, commit 300 unfair labor practices, and rack up more record profits. Caterpillar says it did it to stay competitive with Komatsu. Baloney. Komatsu is struggling with global market share below 3%, while Caterpillar continues to have the lion's share with a healthy profit margin. You know why? Because the United States government has spent American tax dollars fronting them into emerging nations in Europe, including Russia, and helping arrange financing for their operations through the World Bank. And finally, how about this picture? The state of Arizona and the city of Phoenix hail America West Airlines out of bankruptcy with more than $100 million in tax breaks and revenue bonds. The airline agrees not to contract out hangar jobs and rebounds with 11 straight quarters of profitability and stacks up $300 million in reserve. Then the Teamsters crank up an organizing drive aimed at those working at America West. America West shows its respect for our labor laws and thanks the community by illegally firing 535,000 a year machinists and contracting out their jobs to a company in Washington where machinists make only $21,000. That happened last Friday. How many of you want to fly in an airplane that's just been repaired by a $21,000 rookie mechanic? Raise your hands. For American workers and their families, these are snapshots from hell. They paint an ugly portrait of an economy that has lost respect for workers and the jobs that they do. In a prophetic article in the New York Times last January, Louis Chatel added words to the pictures. Something is wrong with America's economic boom, he wrote. After 4 years of ever stronger growth, people's wages should be going up faster than their expenses. For most people, they're not. And this is the first time in decades that a recovery has gone so long without putting more money in more pocketbooks. And now, if the recovery runs out of steam in 1995, as so many economists predict, that money might never show up. You have reported what this means to workers. Between 1947 and 1973, the median paychecks of American workers more than doubled, and the bottom 20% enjoyed the biggest gains. But since 1973, median earnings have fallen by about 15%, and the bottom 20% have fallen the furthest behind. More than 40% of all earnings gains have gone to the richest 1%. Meanwhile, wealth became even more concentrated. The top 20% of all households now control more than 55% of all wealth. The rest of us, 80% of all American households, get to split the rest. Profits are up, productivity is up, executive compensation is up, and the stock market is up. But worker wages and health benefits and pensions are down. Now, you're reporting how great gaps in wages and wealth are hurting American companies and the American economy. Think of the hardworking Iowa family Susan Sheehan describes in a recent article in The New Yorker. Bonita and Kenny Merton live with their two sons in a small home they own in Des Moines. Kenny once had an $11 an hour job before the factory closed. Last year, he made $17,239 hauling sand sacks. Bonita made $13,977 working full-time at Luther Park Nursing Home. After 15 years, she's paid $7.40 an hour. She gets a ham at Easter, turkey at Thanksgiving, $10 for her birthday, and $20 for Christmas. She pays $36 a month for health insurance, $28 a month for dental coverage, and gets no pension. Every year, they go further and further in debt, and there is no hope of ever doing better. Kenny says, there ain't no middle class no more. There's only rich and poor. Now ask yourselves whether families like the Mertens are spending confidently this holiday season. American workers are running out of money, running out of hope, and loaded with debt. That's why retail sales are lagging, why manufacturers are loaded with inventory, and why they cut 32,000 jobs last month. Macy's figured out a new way this week to blame the worker. To compensate for plunging sales, they cut the commissions for their sales clerks. Can you imagine in the middle of all this, the Republicans giving a tax break to the rich by declaring all war on the programs and policies that Kenny and Bonita Merton depend on just for survival? You may have seen the commercials, the television commercials that we're running during the current budget battle. In one of them, Father Julio Perez, a priest in Miami, sums it up for all of us. When, with his eyes filled with tears, he says, I came to America in 1954. What a country we had then. What happened to America? America is becoming angrier, edgier, and meaner. Until we ease the growing gaps in work, wages, and wealth, you will be sending more dispatches from a wounded nation, more malicious movements, more bombings, more hate crimes, and more of the quiet anguish of Americans losing their sense of a common destiny and a common purpose. America will become more like the trouble spots where we send our sons and daughters to keep the peace. So what can we do about it? Of course, American business must change, but I stand here before you today as president of the AFL-CIO because American labor must change. That is why I ran for president of the AFL-CIO, and that is why I won. We understand that while the world and the workplace have changed, labor stood still and lost ground. Just as today, I challenge business to change. Every day on my job as president, I challenge labor to change. First, we have to reach out to unorganized workers because that is the only way we can build a stronger movement. As our membership strength has declined, so has our bargaining power. It used to be that strong unions lifted all workers up. Now, non-union employers are dragging all workers down. Here's the truth. Our weakness encouraged employers to take the low road, and only by rebuilding our strength can we bring American business back to the high road of high wages. That is why I am challenging every union and every level of our labor movement to do what the fastest growing unions are doing, put a bigger share of our resources into organizing. That is why we will be training at least 1,000 organizers over the course of the next 2 years, pouring $20 million into organizing programs and organizing from the Sun Belt to the Rust Belt and from healthcare to high tech. That is why we are rebuilding our grassroots political strength, training candidates and training political organizers. Yesterday, I had the opportunity to talk to the Democratic caucus in the Senate. 30 senators were there. I told them that it was time for the labor movement to end checkbook politics. We're going to demand a voice for working people of this country in setting strategies, defining messages and issues, and a hand in running campaigns. Second, we have to reach out to management from a position of strength, because that is the only way we can build a stronger, high-wage economy. We can no longer afford the luxury that productivity, quality, and competitiveness are not our business. They are our business. They are our jobs, and they are our paychecks. Too many workers have suffered because of foolish and failed, short-sighted management policies. We need to follow the example of workers and their unions in companies and government agencies and school systems all across this country who are winning a voice in improving the products they make and the services they deliver. As labor becomes stronger and smarter, we will really be in a position to offer management this challenge. Take your profits and invest them in growing the American economy, American workers, American wages. Offer your workers the training they need for tomorrow's jobs, not just the big shots in the executive suites, but all your employees. Work with your employees and their unions. Give us a voice in decision making. Give us half a chance to improve the quality of our goods and the quality of our services. That is the path to lasting prosperity, and we want to walk down that road with you. We will offer this challenge with the confidence that we are prepared for conflict or cooperation, and the choice is management's to make. Here's an example. And we have George Corpus, as I said, the president of the machinists, with us today. And the Boeing contract just ratified by 32,000 machinists in Washington, Oregon, and Kansas. Management agreed to give the workers and their unions a voice and decisions to contract out work. Adequate notice, a chance to bid competitively, retraining, and meet and confer language. It's a tremendous agreement. The only trouble was the machinists had to strike for 69 days to get it. Our challenge to management is to avoid conflict and to promote it. Let's spend our time and our money and our energy pursuing higher profits and higher wages. Next year, we will begin to offer these challenges not only to the leaders of labor and leaders of business, but to all Americans. Early next spring, the AFL-CIO will begin to hold hearings on falling living standards in communities all across this country. We will ask working men and women what is happening to their jobs, their paychecks, and their family budgets. We'll take our show on the road from Iowa to New Hampshire, from the South to the Midwest and the Far West, to put the issue of wages at the center of the political debate. We want to get even more of the suggestions that are already pouring in from unlikely sources, like this letter that I just got last week from Rusty Hills in East Lansing, Michigan. He says, "As a conservative Republican, I suspect you and I part company on most political issues. But as a fellow Catholic, I believe strongly in just wages and an equitable distribution of profits." He must have been talking to Monsignor Higgins. He goes on to make a recommendation that we bargain wages by comparing the percentage increase in executive compensation to percentage increases for workers over the past 10 years. In every speech I give, from the press club to the picket lines, I try to make this simple point: America needs a raise. Next year, we'll be asking every candidate for public office, tell working Americans how they'll get them a raise. And in June, we're going to start a union summer as we send 1,000 college students and young workers to organize voter registration and living wage campaigns all across this country. We're going to begin a dialogue with working America, union members and future members alike. And come September, we'll have a union fall as we organize and mobilize working Americans around the fundamental issue of raising wages and increasing incomes. If Americans vote on the issue of who can lift the poor and secure the middle class, I am confident they will make the right choices for president as well as Congress. Here's my prediction for 1996. If the Republicans continue to pursue their extremist economic agenda and Bill Clinton continues to stand tall against it, we will win back the House and make substantial gains in the Senate and reelect our president. Somebody said the Republicans won the last election by saying, "They took it from you and they gave it to them," meaning poor people. We can win this one by saying, "They tried to take it from you and give it to themselves." We take that message to every workplace and every polling place, then we will win. And we can begin to close the gap between those who do the work of America and those who control their lives and livelihoods. I believe, in the words of the Nobel Prize-winning poet Seamus Heaney, whose writings inspired so many fighters for peace and justice, "History says, don't hope on this side of the grave. But once in a lifetime, the longed-for tidal wave of justice can rise up, and hope and history rhyme. Soon, you will see our labor movement rising up like the longed-for tidal wave of justice, and working men and women will once again make hope and history rhyme." Thank you very much.
Swinney, we have a number of questions here. To start off, you had mentioned your conflict or confrontation approach to business. And we noticed in New York the other day you spoke to business leaders, offering them a social compact where unions would forego confrontation if corporations adopted a more respectful attitude towards unions. Have you had a response from business? And if so, what is it?
There are enough major initiatives taking place in many workplaces around the country, which shows a sincere spirit of cooperation of individual employers working with their unions to achieve significant labor management solutions. There has been some outreach from some of the national associations of the business community to sit down and talk about these issues. I think that we have raised the level of focus on the need for good labor management programs. We have a number of examples. I think what has been achieved in the Boeing contract is just one indication of a company that has moved in a very positive direction of creating a level playing field for labor and management. I had the opportunity to tour the U.S. Steel plant with George Becker back about a month or so ago, and to see an operation on the part of a major corporation, a major union, working together on the work floor with a labor management team that discusses the quality of their product, the quality of the steel they're producing, that discusses all of the issues of labor and management working together, a high productivity, high profit operation with a very good human resource program that includes a retraining and training for second careers. And this is an industry that has seen a lot of the change take place as a result of high technology, but it's responsible management working with responsible union to address the issues of change and to recognize the fact that you cannot stop change, but you certainly can protect your most precious resource, which is your workforce. American workers are such high producers, and we should be working on more of these kinds of programs.
Do you see the message about the widening wage gap between rich and poor getting across? Isn't this beginning to take on a new life in our political arena? To what avail?
Our polling and focus group work shows that this is an issue that is not just a union issue, is not just an organized labor issue. There is a lot of anxiety all across this country among American workers who do not feel that they are getting their fair share of the success and the good economy, who are not deriving any benefit from it, and yet are contributing so much to the success. This crosses union lines, this crosses industries, regions, and so on. My hope is that we can raise the level of focus on this issue and that we can debate this issue during the political campaigns next year, because it really requires national policy as well as a positive program on the part of management to address what is happening and what is frustrating and making workers so angry all across the country.
We have two related questions. Were you giving advice to the French strikers who appear to have shut down Paris tight? Do you see this happening in the United States under your leadership? And the second question, how does blocking traffic on the 14th Street Bridge contribute to public support for labor objectives?
I think both of those examples are related. I'm not one for encouraging those kinds of activities, but I think we see in France how angry workers are. Now, here's a country where their percentage of the workforce is less organized than we are in the United States. I believe they have somewhere between 8 and 10% of the workforce. But it just goes to show you how angry workers can get when they see the guts of their social programs being ripped apart. And I admire the French workers for what they're doing. I also admire the janitors who blocked the 14th Street Bridge. We don't want to use those kinds of tactics, but we have to raise the level of perception where minimum wage workers working in a very wealthy industry, the real estate industry here in D.C., are just being treated and exploited so much. The real estate industry has to realize that they have to start providing health benefits and pension benefits and raise the standard of living of these workers. And these workers have decided that some of these tactics are what is necessary to do that. They haven't gone on strike. They did these short-term activities in an effort to get business and government to focus more on their frustrations and their suffering. And so I would support workers taking advantage of these opportunities where the situation is so serious and requires that kind of activity.
Why is the environment so unsuccessful in organizing emerging industries such as computers and other technologies?
I believe that there are tremendous opportunities for organizing workers in the new workforce as well as the old workforce. I think that each of these opportunities requires different techniques and different programs and requires an opportunity to listen to workers and what their issues might be and to find ways that workers are most comfortable in organizing in different industries. We plan to be working with the affiliates, all the unions of the AFL-CIO, in all of the broad range of industries. There are organizing opportunities in every industry. The high-tech industry requires some special attention in terms of it's highly unorganized, and the issues of those workers can vary from industry to industry, and we have to use new techniques. We have to use focus groups and polling and surveying and so on. And if there is some alternative method of organizing that those workers are more comfortable with, we should be taking an opportunity to develop pilot programs. And what works, we should develop even further. What doesn't work, we should find new models and new opportunities. And I think that we can do that. A number of our unions are heavily engaged in trying new methods and new forms of association in order to attract workers. Workers are hungry for organization because workers are feeling a lot of pain as a result of the wage situation, as a result of the number of workers who are not covered for health insurance, and a number of other issues. They also have issues that are peculiar to their own work and their own industry. Office workers, in many cases, feel more comfortable forming an association that addresses sexual harassment, pay equity, promotional opportunities, whatever it might be, and eventually feel that the only way to achieve true solutions to their workplace problems is to get into traditional collective bargaining. But that's an organizational opportunity that has to really develop a program and a strategy that those workers are most comfortable with.
As you might imagine, Mr. Sweeney, we have a number of questions about the Detroit newspaper strike, but let me ask two. Given what happened in the Detroit newspaper strike, the papers never missed a day of publishing, and the advancement of newspaper technology, do you think we have seen the last successful newspaper strike? And perhaps the answer is right here. Why do you think the unions lost the Detroit newspaper strike?
I think that the Detroit newspaper strike is very much alive and very active, and I'm confident that strike is going to be won. I believe that there are problems in the newspaper publishing business that have to be addressed. But here you have a group of workers from, I guess, about four or five different unions who have attempted over a long period of time to negotiate a fair contract. We met with those. Rich Trumka has been coordinating our efforts on a lot of these strategic approach activities that we have, and we're hopeful that the newspaper strike can and will be resolved if the publishers want to have some serious negotiation and address the issues that those workers feel have to be addressed in those negotiations.
Have you visited President Clinton in the White House since your election? If so, can you tell us what you talked about? If not, do you expect to do so soon?
Yes, we have visited with the President. He invited Linda and Rich and myself over to the White House after our election. We spent an hour talking about many of the issues that we're talking about here today. He was interested in hearing our own views and our own plans, and was also responding to some of our concerns about the budget deficit debate and what attempts are being made to cut back on Medicare and Medicaid and education and the environment and so many programs that are so important to working families. And we hope to continue to have that dialogue with the President on better ways that we can truly represent the issues of America's workers.
House Speaker Gingrich called your election to the AFL-CIO presidency potentially a disaster. Does that mean your home base can only be with the Democratic Party, or should labor be the foundation for a third party?
Well, I think that Congressman Gingrich's response to our election was a compliment. I come from New York and have a long history of being very active politically, and have worked with Republicans as well as Democrats. Unfortunately, there are too few Republicans today who are concerned about the issues that America's workers are concerned about. And what we see going on in Congress at the present time with the present leadership is as strong an example as we could possibly use. I don't think that the majority of the Congress was elected to cut back on all of the social programs that this nation has built up over the past 50 years. And I would look forward to seeing some Republicans elected who would be more progressive in dealing with the economic issues and the other issues that America's workers are so concerned about. And until that time, we will have to continue working with those members of the Democratic Party who are supportive of those issues and who do want to realize that there is a crisis with working families all across the country.
Secretary of Labor Wright and other national leaders have placed great reliance on training as the highway to jobs and prosperity. Is this the right way, or is there another way? Will spending on training lift our people to higher levels of prosperity?
I believe that if we're going to address the changes that are taking place in our economy and whether they be with the export of jobs or the deal with high technology, whatever the issues may be, that we should have a strong human resource program in every workplace with every employer. Training is one part of that, but I think it's an important part. And if we're going to talk about job security and talk about workers who are willing to accept the fact that things are changing, we have to afford them the opportunities to second careers, to employment in the technological changes that are taking place, and retraining. And I believe that it's a major part of a successful program addressing workplace issues and has to be a firm commitment on the part of government as well as the private business sector to afford their workers the opportunities to be trained and retrained, whether it's for another career or it's for upgrading in their own changes that are taking place in their own workplace.
Am I correct in understanding that you intend to work toward the unionization of Mexican workers? If so, this plan to work directly toward that end or to support Mexican unions financially by training their people?
I'm sure that Linda and Rich and I would like to say that that we will do everything in our power to work together with the Mexican labor movement. I think it's important that we have these relationships not only with our neighbors in Mexico and Canada, but also throughout the world with those who are building free democratic trade unions. I think that that more emphasis has to be placed on the conditions of Mexican workers, and a major consideration in our opposition to NAFTA was over the conditions of Mexican workers and how the exportation of jobs from the United States to Mexico would go to lower wages, exploited workers. And so we would be looking to work with the labor movement in Mexico to see how we could improve or help to improve the standard of living for Mexican workers as well.
The Supreme Court recently gave the green light to salting, or the organizing technique used heavily in the construction industry. Do you expect this technique to now expand into other industries? And perhaps you could give a brief explanation of salting.
Well, there are some here who are better able at answering that question from the operating engineers and the laborers union, but we will be working together with the unions that represent building and construction trades to see how we can address their organizing and how we can deal with the Supreme Court decision, and that's a discussion that's going on right now.
And the AFL-CIO really direct a national organizing campaign, or is this the job of affiliated unions?
This is clearly the job of affiliated unions, and the program that we're talking about at the AFL-CIO is to supplement the work of the affiliated unions, to work together with them in any ways that we can assist. And one of the major priorities is to train new organizers. We have a very successful institute called the Organizing and Training Institute, which was introduced about 4 or 5 years ago and has been training several hundred organizers for affiliates, for campaigns that affiliates are involved in. We intend to increase that number 5 or 6 times. We also are working with smaller unions that do not have the resources for organizing campaigns and may not have the staff, to see how we can help them in organizing in their industry. And we will also be assessing campaigns, looking at where we have, what are the successful methods of organizing and what have been the failures, and assessing those campaigns and working together with the affiliates to see how we change the models of those unsuccessful campaigns and turn them into successful ones.
We have political questions that I'll put together, a couple of them. Will you have a target in the target list in Congress in the 1996 congressional contest? And do you plan to meet with the Republican leaders in Congress? And if so, what message will you give them?
Yes, I plan to meet with the Republican leadership in Congress, and I will be delivering the same message I delivered here today. I'm not sure what kind of reception I will get, but I certainly will try. We will be conducting a massive political effort starting right after the first of the year in congressional districts all across this country, educating our members about the issues, motivating them to get active in campaigns in every congressional district, and raising the level of education and communication, not only for organized workers, but for them to be delivering the message in their communities, to their neighbors, and to their friends. And we hope to be able to turn the Congress around next year.
Enforcement of OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Act, dropped drastically in 1995. But it has been working for labor unions. How vital is enforcement of the act to the AFL-CIO, and what will you do to push for more stringent enforcement in the future?
Occupational safety and health is not just a union issue. There is no stronger issue in terms of the average worker in this country, whether they're union or non-union. Safety and health is so important to every working family. It doesn't make any difference what kind of act you have if you don't have enforcement. And one of the areas that's under attack in the present budget discussion is the enforcement of OSHA and other labor laws as well. And we are striving to not only protect the present law, but also to strengthen the enforcement, because it's so critical to the lives of workers and to the lives of members of the AFL-CIO.
Back to the Detroit newspaper strike. In your response to the Detroit newspaper strike question, you said newspaper publishers have problems that need to be addressed. Please elaborate.
I was thinking in terms of what the issues are in most of newspaper negotiations in recent years, and the experiences that we've had in a couple of different strike situations. Jim Norton is here, who is president of one of the unions that represents many of the members in Detroit. I just think that there has to be serious negotiations going on about the issues that that the publisher is concerned about the changes. We are not sure what is the real reason for this prolonged strike, whether it is a tactic on the part of management to be making some business decisions while the strike is going on, whether the two papers are going to survive in Detroit. And we think that if the employers could just get down to bargaining a contract with those workers, that strike could be resolved.
What is the significance of the recent generous Boeing contract settlement when viewed in light of the Caterpillar return to work without a contract?
Many question the advisability of strikes these days. Well, Boeing is a good example of a successful strike. The fact that these workers had to sacrifice for more than 2 months in order to achieve what seems to be a very fair contract is unfortunate. I believe that, and George Corpus could better explain, but I believe that if management had dealt with some of these issues up front, that they could have avoided a strike. Caterpillar is a very unfortunate experience of the pain and suffering that workers who are members of a great, strong union, the UAW, but how those members struck so long, how their lives were affected, and I think that that's a situation that requires some study about whether there were some earlier tactics that could have been used, and this, the UAW is closely watching the situation, but they made a decision that that it was important to preserve the jobs of these workers and to get them back to work, and to also hope that the whole process of the 300 unfair labor charges that are pending before the National Labor Relations Board would be disposed of in a positive way in behalf of the rights of those workers. I'm hopeful that that we can spend more time among ourselves in analyzing some of these experiences to see how we can be stronger and more effective on behalf of the members.
Mr. Sweeney, we have time for one more question, but before, I would like to present you with a certificate of appreciation from the club for your appearance here. And the cup of the National Press Club for your morning coffee.
Thank you.
The last question alludes a bit to that bridge on 14th Street. Since you're not one to say, I'll cross that bridge when I come to it, tell us where the labor movement will be in the year 2000.
I feel rather strongly that the American labor movement will be a much stronger and stronger in voice, stronger in membership, stronger in perception. I think that what we are embarked on in terms of change, in changing our numbers, in massive organizing drives among workers who want to be organized, in strengthening our political voice and improving our perception, not only among our own members, but with the public at large, better educating and communicating to our members and to the community, that you will see a much stronger labor movement in the year 2000.
Thank you very much, Mr. Sweeney. Thank you.